many of us are courageous and bold enough and honest enough to admit, yes, I re-gift. Who wants to admit that and say that, you know? Anybody actually want to admit that you've already this year re-gifted something? Anybody, huh? Well, we've been on this journey, this whole series, the Not So Big Christmas. The very first week, we talked about reducing and downsizing our Christmas so we could really appreciate Christmas for what it is for us. And then last week, we talked about recreating traditions, and the traditions should be things that trigger positive things inside of us, either emotions or memories or spiritual growth. Next week, we're going to talk about reflect, that's it, reflect. I just think of that old Steve Martin movie. Remember that old Steve Martin movie, trying to call off the dogs and react, release, that's what. I'm really off target now. We reflect on things we've learned, and today we're going to talk about re-gifting. Before we go any further, why don't we pray and ask God to help us this morning? God, we could be a lot of different places right now, but we're right here. And I think that we're right here for a reason, because I think that you are going to do something inside of this place and inside many of us is very special today. And at least I pray that that happens. Pray that all of us see you for who you are and get a new perspective on you and encounter you in a very special way. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. You know, the thing about re-gifting something is we basically get a twofer. You know, on the one hand, we get rid of something that we otherwise would throw in the garbage or would clutter up our closets or something like that. And the second thing is we do is we save money. You know, we reduce our Christmas spending by just re-gifting something that somebody already gave to us. But I want to actually re-gift today. I want to do re-gifting, and this is not something I'm going to give you that I don't like. It's not something I'm going to give you I don't use. In fact, what I'm going to give you is something that I use every single day. And it's also the greatest thing that I've ever received in my life. It's also something that as I give it to you, I'm not really going to lose it. But as I give it, it's actually going to grow inside of me. I'm actually going to get the benefits of this in a much greater and more significant way. And what I'm going to talk about today is give you the greatest gift that I or anybody can receive. And that is what it means to have a personal relationship with God. Now, I know that that sounds can sound trite to some of us. It can sound unrealistic, and it can trigger off all kinds of emotions inside of us. But I really know, because I've personally experienced, what it means to have a relationship with God. And it's the core heart of what Christmas is all about. And this message of Christmas didn't start 2,000 years ago. I hear many people who have problems with Jesus, or more specifically, no one has a problem with Jesus. Everyone loves Jesus. But more specifically, has a problem with the religion of Christianity, or a problem with people who call themselves Christians. And one of the criticisms that would be leveled against us is that, well, this Jesus has been around for 2,000 years, and you know, how dare you think that this is such a great thing, such a great religion, when there's other things that have been around a heck of a lot longer. I don't think of my faith in Christ as a religion, though it is affiliated with the Christian religion, so much as I do is it is a relationship. And this relationship goes way back beyond 2,000 years when Jesus was born. It goes thousands of years earlier. Judaism is almost universally seen as the oldest religion in the history of the world. And what Christianity is that it is a continuation and a fulfillment, a completion, if you will, of Judaism and the principles that are in the Jewish scriptures, or also the exact same as the Old Testament portion of the Bible. And we've been starting to see this in the midst of this service as I've been quoting Old Testament Jewish scriptures from the prophets such as Isaiah, who talked about what it was going to be like for God's Son to come, the Prince of Peace, the Wonderful Counselor, and for His government to come and increase in our lives. Last week we talked about a lot of the traditional symbols that are associated with Christmas. We talked about how the Christmas wreath for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years has triggered the memories of many Christ followers and thinking of how Jesus is actually the king and had a crown of thorns put on his head. And one of the traditional symbols of Christmas that I didn't talk about last week, I want to talk about today, is bells. Bells. When we talk about Christmas bells, there's bells everywhere. You know, we see in Christmas commercials, or how many of you actually are displaying Christmas bells in your house in some way, shape, or form? Christmas, okay, some of you, you know. You might not know what those things mean. I'm going to tell you today what those things mean. They have nothing to do with hell's bells, by the way. So that was a great song by AC/DC. They have nothing to do with Christmas. And I have no idea where the idea of hell's bells comes from. I really don't. I don't see anywhere in Scripture where there's bells in hell. Maybe I haven't read that part. But there is a very consistent communication in the Scriptures about bells. Bells were the things, or some of the things, that were attached to the Old Testament priests, to the Judaic priests. See, what there was is there was a gap between God and people. So as you read the Old Testament Scriptures, this gap was filled by intermediaries. They're basically middlemen. And so whenever God wanted to say something to people, he would communicate to prophets, who would then communicate to people. And whenever the people wanted to say something to God, they would communicate through the priest, who was their middleman, to God. So priests and prophets were these middlemen to deal with the chasm that existed between men and women. And Jesus is seen as the fulfillment of the things that are communicated in the Old Testament. And one of the things he's seen as the fulfillment of, he's seen as the ultimate high priest, the ultimate fulfiller of all of the priestly duties. In the book of Hebrews, it's in the New Testament, it is a book that's written to the Hebrews to specifically connect the dots between all the things they celebrated in their Jewish traditions and their Jewish faith and how Jesus has completed and fulfilled those things. Here's what it says in the book of Hebrews chapter 4. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. It says that Jesus is the ultimate high priest. I don't know if you ever thought before about why God would come to the earth in the form of a baby. I think there's two reasons why he came to the earth in the form of a baby. One reason is, nobody is afraid of a baby. And God didn't intend when he came to the earth to completely freak us out. I remember when the first time I watched Terminator in the movie theaters. You know, that movie freaked me out. I was up like all night just thinking about all the ramifications of it. But in the movie Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger comes down and is this fully pumped being in this, you know, globe thing, and wham, wham, and crashes. He's totally naked, nude. He's filled on steroids, probably. He comes in, this massive thing. I'm thinking to myself, now, if I came to the earth, that's how I'd want to come, right there. Let me come like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Why would God want to come as a baby? If I'm God, I'm coming like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm not coming like a little baby. I think one of the reasons is because God never intended to freak us out. And everybody's willing to accept and to deal with a child. Second reason that God came to the earth in the form of a child is because it was important for Jesus as our high priest to experience the full bandwidth of human experience. See, the priest, he's a great representative of people when he understands and identifies with what people have experienced. And so with God coming to the earth as a child and growing up, he experienced the full bandwidth of human experience. He experienced all the temptations that you and I experience. He experienced peer pressure as a 12-year-old. He experienced, you know, the difficulty of struggling to get a date, probably, and how that, you know, impacted his life. He experienced everything. He experienced greed, or the temptation for greed. Now, Jesus never experienced a specific temptation to falsify his expense report, because he didn't have an expense report. But the ultimate root of greed behind that, he experienced that. He wrestled with that. He experienced the temptation of lust. Temptation of selfishness. He experienced that. Just because you were tempted in something doesn't mean that that in and of itself is sin. And this high priest, he experienced all those things so he can relate with what you and I are actually experiencing, but he never actually followed through on it. Hebrews 5:1 says that every high priest is selected from among men and is appointed to represent them in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. We've got our little priest that's been back here during the services, which is a recreation of some of the things they used to do in the midst of the temple. Their temple was basically their church service. And they would have the inner holy of holies, where the priest, the people's representative, would go to offer gift and offer sacrifices for sins. And they would do a lot of things in there. They would do stuff like light incense, like he's doing. They would also continually wash themselves and cleanse themselves. Because it was important to be the people's representative. When you went into the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum, the place where God's glory dwelt, that you were prepared, that you were clean. It's very interesting, around his garb, he had obvious bells that you're hearing. He also had pomegranates. So it would go bell, pomegranate, all the way around the hem of his garment. And the pomegranate is believed to be there because it signified the very first sin, the very first bit of dirt that ever happened in humanity, which is when Adam and Eve ate from the tree that God told them not to eat from, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And some of us have said, now, you know, why is it called the knowledge of good and evil, and why was it not good to eat from it? Well, it's because once they ate from that tree, at that moment you could have knowledge between good and evil, because prior to that there was no evil, so you had no need to have knowledge between good and evil. And they would have the pomegranate around the edge to represent the fact that they had fallen, they had done things that weren't right, and there was a separation between them and God, which is why the middlemen existed. Yesterday, I came to church last night, and I was doing some painting, and I tried to get myself as clean as I could before I came up here to speak. You know, it's like when you paint, no matter what you do, you get paint all over yourself, right? And if I'm just running around doing errands, I look pretty gnarly. In fact, sometimes I bump into some of you while I'm doing errands. I'm like, oh man, I should have washed or something, you know? I have a different standard for my own personal cleanliness when I'm just doing life than when I come up here on stage. Because when I come up here on stage underneath the lights in front of 1,200 people like about we have right now, I got 2,400 eyes on me, and I'm like, man, I need to look good. I gotta get myself clean. So I am scrubbing myself up and everything. And I sit here this morning, right here, I look down, and somehow, once I got this building, I got dirt all over my pants. And some of you have noticed this. I normally would have never noticed dirt on my pants. Have you been noticing my dirt? You have, haven't you? What are you looking down there for? You shouldn't be looking at it. That was dirty. I see right here, there's this dirt all over myself, and I would normally never notice that I had that level of dirt on my pants, except I know when I'm coming up here, there's a different standard for cleanliness. And so this is what it was like for the priest. The priest needed to be the cleanest. They needed to be washed. They needed to be right, because when they were going to go before God, they knew that God had standards, and you needed to be as clean as possible. And we all recognize this. You go to a wedding, you go to some great function, you want to be clean. You want to be right. And so the bells around the hem of the garment were right above the rope that was tied to the ankle of the priest. And he would walk in the Holy of Holies, and he would be behind a very thick veil. You could not see the guy. You could see a shadow here, but you could not see the guy. And that just further accentuated the fact that there was a distance and separation between basic people and God based on our dirtiness, based on our sin. And what the people do is they would listen for the bells. And they knew if they heard the bells, the dude was still living. If they didn't hear the bells, they knew he wasn't walking around, he was dead, because God decided to strike him dead. And they would then take the rope, and it was attached to his ankle, and they'd pull him out. And they'd say, well, God, I guess you weren't clean enough to go and see God. They would do stuff. They would keep him up the night before, just in case he had some nasty dreams. You know what I'm talking about? They would have him not go to bed the night before, just in case he had some really bad and pure thoughts that he couldn't control, that then when he went before God, he would have to deal with. See, God has these incredibly high standards. He has this holiness standard that's hard for some of us to understand. Last week I talked about the debate we had when we built this building about wood-burning fireplace, and I talked about me being a seagull manager. I'd come into meetings, you know, when they weren't planning on doing a wood-burning fireplace, and I'd be like a seagull. I'd come in out of nowhere, I'd make a bunch of noise, and when I left, there was crap all over the place, you know. And, you know, if you just heard that story, I would really sound like an ogre and like an idiot. And in many ways, I'm an idiot, but not in this way, I'm not an idiot. Because what I didn't tell you last week was this. There was very clear communicated standards that I had about having a real wood-burning fireplace. And the team had agreed on those. It was very, very clear. We cannot have a fake fireplace. This is a real place for real people, not a real place for fake people with fake fireplaces, you know? If you want to have that in your house, that's cool. But in this place, we're going to have a real fireplace. And so when the communicated standards were not followed through on, and I came into a meeting, my integrity demanded that I say something. I had to. And if I didn't say something, then my integrity of a leader was shot, because it really means I wasn't really serious about what I said. And if you've ever been in an organization where there's core values or something like that, but everyone breaks them and no one really gives a rip, you know what I'm talking about. There's no integrity in the organization. There's no, if you will, no holiness, no completeness. And God clearly communicates standards to us, clearly communicates in the Bible. And even if you've never heard the Bible or read the Bible, God also writes these things on our hearts. And oftentimes the things that we feel or sense or our conscience, oftentimes it works perfectly in sync with what God has clearly communicated in the Bible. And so when we don't follow through on those things, there's dirt on us. There's what's called sin. And the separation widens before God, and there must be consequences. Some of us feel like, well, if God is this great God of love, then doesn't he always have the obligation to feel great about me? You know what we call people who expect others to always feel good about them regardless of what they do? We call them dysfunctional. That's what we call them. And nowhere else in our human experience do we expect people to always have warm emotions about us no matter what we do. Okay? But somehow we expect God to have this form of love that is God's excited and having incredible emotions about us regardless of what we do. Friends, that's not love. That's whacked. That's wishful thinking. There is this love of God that we're going to talk about today, and then there's also this thing called justice. Both of them have to go together, or God has no integrity. He's not worth taking serious. There must be justice for that which is broken that he clearly communicated about. And the whole role of the priest was to be that role of justice bearer, because he would take animal sacrifices and he'd put them on altars, and the animals would burn and they would be sacrificed, and the people would remember, I should be the one who's on the altar. I should be the one who's being consumed by the fire, because I'm the one who's done what shouldn't have been done. There's a critical point in our spiritual life. We come to realize that I really can't do it on my own. The critical point we have to come to at some point, we realize I really don't have the ability to spiritually heal myself. It's a critical point. I was thinking about this last week as I was playing basketball. I jammed my thumb. It was while I was on the way down from my slam. My tooth chipped on the rim, and then my thumb got caught in the net. And I did jam my thumb playing basketball. That wasn't how. But it was excruciating pain. I was like, I couldn't run anymore. I couldn't really play anymore. It was killing me. It was killing me all day. But you know what I didn't do? I didn't go call 911. I really didn't. And maybe I should have, but I didn't go call people and say, oh, would you please come pray for my thumb? Maybe I should have. I didn't do that. You know why I didn't do that? Because I knew that my body's own recuperative healing powers would take over and I'd be fine. I knew that I'd be hurting for a day. I knew the next few days my thumb would be stiff. I knew it's getting better every day as it is right now, and I know in another few days, I'll be able to go back playing ball again. And so therefore, I wasn't too freaked out about it. I knew there could be a natural healing process that would take over on my thumb. It isn't until we come to a point where we realize, man, I have cancer, or I have something else, and I know that I can't naturally heal this, that we start getting extreme and thinking, all right, what do I have to do to deal with this? And there's this critical spiritual moment we realize, I can't heal myself. I've got so much dirt on myself right now. And even if I scrubbed off all the dirt on me and all the paint and all that kind of stuff, I still got crap from years and years and years and years ago. What do I do with that? When we come to recognize that stuff, that's when we're at a spiritual defining moment. Zechariah 3:8, which is another one of God's prophets, Zechariah, one of his middlemen communicating to us, said this, "Listen, O high priest Joshua, and your associates seated before you, who are men symbolic of things to come, I'm going to bring my servant." What's he saying? He's saying, all you priests and all that you're doing behind the veil, all that you do, you're symbolic of what is to come. I am going to bring my servant. He's going to be Jesus Christ, and he is going to fully represent all that you've done, literally follow through and all the symbolic things that you are doing, and totally and utterly complete it. See, what Jesus did as the high priest is he came into this world as a child. He experienced all of life so he could recognize and identify with you and I like a priest would, like a pastor would, like a preacher would. And then what he did, as opposed to taking an animal and putting it on the altar and sacrificing it, he himself as a priest jumped onto the altar itself. No priest had ever jumped on and burned himself. No priest had ever laid his life on the line for somebody else. And actually, even if a priest had done that, all he would have been doing is dealing with his own personal sin. See, because if a priest would have done that, no matter how hard he tried, no matter how clean he was, he still had sin in his life. And it would still be himself that would need to pay for that sin. The integrity of God would demand that. But what Jesus did when he was dealing with all the temptations and never following through, when he actually went to the altar or the cross and spreads his arms out and said, God, this is how much I love people. This is how much we love people. And this is how we're going to fully satisfy love and justice, because out of sacrificial love, I am going to satisfy the justice that other people deserve. How do you and I know that God's a sacrificial God? How do we know that God is into sacrificial love? I would submit to you, and I'd ask you to think through, that you don't know that any other way than the reputation and the legacy of Jesus. Think about this for a moment. Anybody in any religion or any understanding of God can know that God is a God of order and design. You can take a look at nature, and you can see nature, and you can say, wow, look at how all these elements fit together, and there's an intricacy and a balance in nature. There must be a designer who could design this. And many scientists who are not Christ followers and used to be hardcore atheists are more and more saying, man, the more we learn about the universe and creation, the more we see this little intricacy, there must be a creator or a designer behind this. You can know that God is into design and into intricacy by looking at nature. You can also know by looking at the beings of nature that God is a nurturing God. You can see how you and I care for our young, or the animal kingdom cares for its young and all that stuff. And you can say, man, based on how we see this level of nurture, God must be a nurturer. You can know that God is a nurturer. You can also know that God is merciful. You know that every time you take a look at somebody who's done you wrong and you're like, man, God, when are they going to get theirs? Please have them get theirs right now. You know, don't we know people like that? They have all kind of money. You're like, why do you have money? You should have nothing. They have all kinds of nice things. You're like, why do you have these? And you deserve justice. And the fact that they're not getting justice right now, or we personally are not getting justice right now, we realize, gosh, God is a very patient, forbearing, long-suffering, merciful God. But where do we get the picture of somebody dying for when they don't need to die? You ever dated somebody who says, baby, I love you and I'd die for you? You're right. Yeah. You're right. Man, how many times has that said to you? And has anyone ever done that? Of course, if you ever get married, then you really hope they literally follow through and die for you, you know, because you're like, but Jesus is the one person who literally followed through on this. 1 John 3:16 says this. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. This was written by hardcore Jews of Jews. These are people who were steeped in their traditions, who had massive, massive blocks of the Old Testament memorized. I have a hard time, as I said before, memorizing the Pledge of Allegiance, but these guys had whole massive blocks memorized. And they're going, this is the only time I've ever seen sacrificial love. To see what Jesus did, going from the cradle to the cross, is unbelievable. For you and I, the ultimate worst point of our lives is when we die. It's our lowest point of life. But for Jesus, it was the ultimate pinnacle of his life, because that's what the priests lived for. The priests lived for sacrifice, and Jesus lived to sacrifice himself. He lived to go from a cradle to the cross, so we can get all warm, touchy, feely, gooey about a cradle or about him being placed in a manger. But unless we have the cross right beside it, that thing is hollow. It's lifeless. It's meaningless. It's nothing more than a religious trapping as opposed to a trigger to help us understand the depth of God. I want to give you something this morning. Those of you, if you're sitting this way, on this side of the aisle, there's a box or a bag. Pick up that bag, please. Pick up that bag. Take a box out of it. Don't open it up. Pass it on down. You know, as our priest is walking around and doing things, there came an ending point. There came an ending point to the ministry of the priest. There was an ultimate ending point to the ministry of the priest. And the ending point was when Jesus himself, the priest, put himself on the altar and the cross. And at that moment, a priest was no longer necessary. A priest is defined by someone who you need to go between you and God. The priest was no longer necessary and will never be necessary again. Because once Jesus went to the cross, this gap, this middleman thing, was eliminated, because now we have the opportunity to come face to face with God ourselves. Now we have the ability to come face to face with God ourselves. The Christmas bells, what that traces back to, is it traces back to how the people would sit outside the temple and they would listen for the bells. And they knew so long as they heard the bells, the priest lives. And what early Christ followers realize is that the gift of Christ, who Christ is, it is the greatest gift that God has ever given, but it must be received. And when it is received, when Jesus is received, he lives inside the new temple, which is our bodies. And wherever a Christ follower goes, there Jesus goes. And the Christmas bells remind us that the priest still lives inside here. Have you ever given a gift that, by the way, in Video Cafe, if you haven't found your bags yet, they are right underneath the chairs or underneath the tables. Sorry about not telling that earlier. Have you ever given a gift that was never received? I mean, giving a gift to somebody, I'm giving you this, but unless you receive it, it really means nothing to you. It's when you receive it, it means something. I've given gifts before, like a friends of mine at a party, I remember, giving them gifts, and then when I left, I was the last one to leave that night, I saw the gifts strewn all over the floors, ignored and walked on. It felt great giving it, but unless there's a completion of people actually receiving it and valuing it, it's empty. The loop isn't closed. The loop isn't completed. And just because Jesus died on the cross, just because Christmas is about the Son of God coming to be our ultimate priest and to eliminate the barrier that exists between us and God. And by the way, can't some of us feel that barrier? Can't we feel it? Can't we feel sometimes that God just seems way, way out there? Can't we just feel sometimes that, I don't know, where the heck are you? And even in the midst of pain, and even in the midst of joy and happiness, sometimes we're just wondering, where is God? Where is? We feel that separation oftentimes because we've never received the gift. We've never made the intentional decision to have a spiritually defining moment where we receive the gift. You ever been given a gift you didn't do anything with? I have. A few years ago, I was going through my sock drawer, the back recess of my sock drawer. You know what that's like, you know? It means that laundry haven't been done for a while, so I'm trying to find socks that aren't really matching, but they're close enough and no one will know, you know, that whole thing. So when you're in that portion of the drawer, there's all kind of nasties back there that you haven't found for a while. And I found this envelope. I pull this envelope and I open it up and it was a massage certificate. And I was like, score, score. I forgot someone had given me this massage certificate. I'm all fired up about this massage certificate. And then I take a look at the expiration date and I'm like, oh, it had expired like months earlier. So I'm in a panic, and I call up the place that the certificate had been bought from. I said, hey, I got this certificate. Can I still use it? Can I do it? And I said, I'm not, sorry, sir, you can't. It had expired. I couldn't believe this place would not let me use a certificate. TriHealth is their name. TriHealth. Anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 tapes and CDs are going to go out here this weekend. Remember those two words. Try health. I was so bummed because, you know, I don't... spending 65 bones on someone doing their hands on my back feels awesome. It's not my preferred place, you know, to spend money. So this thing expired. I was totally bummed. Totally, totally bummed. It expired. Another time it happened, I found another envelope back there and pulled it out. And it was a Home Depot gift card. I say Home Depot because there was no expiration on it. It didn't expire. I use it. Home Depot, you know. Home Depot, you know. The gift of Christ has an expiration date. It expires on death. It expires on death. There is this gift, there is this offer to receive the priest, to receive the life of Christ, to receive God's justice, to have Jesus pay the justice for you instead of you paying it for the rest of eternity. And the offer for that gift expires upon death. It's a sign of how much God cares for you. Let me tell you something. God digs you totally. If God had a refrigerator, your face would be on it. If God had a wallet, your picture would be in it. If God had a calendar, all the key moments of your year would be written in there ahead of time. If God had a diary, all the things that he's crazy about you would be journaled with meticulous detail. He is enraptured with every detail of your life. He is a fan of yours like nobody is a fan of yours. He is passionate for you. He is compassionate, which is why we still are here, not strict dead. He is completely enthralled with you. That's why he and his son Jesus had this whole master plan of satisfying his justice, satisfying his integrity. And the offer to us is whether or not we want to receive the gift. Open the top of that box, if you will. Just open it. Don't do anything else. Just look inside there. Just look at that. And here's what that is, the Christmas bell. Don't jingle it right now, please. You don't follow instructions very well. I said just look at it. You know, inside that box is something representative of the life of Christ. The priestly garment, the thing that signifies his life. And what you've just had offered to you today is the gift in language you can understand, hopefully, and is an offer to receive the priest, to receive the life of Christ, to receive him into your life. A few weeks ago, I said this was going to be a defining Christmas for many of us, and it was going to mark us. This is that moment. This is that moment. This is that moment where there is a gift that is in your hands that is representative of the total human history. All of human history boils down to moments like this. You are not an accident. The life of Christ is not an accident. The Bible is not an accident. The role of the priests and the ancient traditions are not an accident. They all weave together like a seamless tapestry that show the most amazing love story that has ever been written or thought of in human history. And you are at the center of it. I remember when I received this gift. I was in high school, and I was a religious guy for years and years and years going to church. But it wasn't until someone told me in language that I could understand how this all fit together that I actually received the gift of a relationship with God, that my life changed. Some of us are going to do that right now. I ask you to just bow your heads. Let's just bow our heads for a moment here. God, I remember. I remember that moment in high school. I remember being in the mountains of Pennsylvania in the wintertime. Remember kneeling in the back of a cabin on wooden steps. And it's like yesterday that I can remember it. I can remember the frozen wooden steps underneath my knees. I remember how hard they were. I also remember the coldness that seeped through the fabric of my pants into my knees. I can remember the sound of the leaves rustling. I can remember the smell of the winter air. I can remember every detail about that. I remember that because That was a moment where I was marked. That was a moment where the greatest gift that had ever been given to me was received. The gift of having a relationship with you that's only grown stronger for the last 20-some years. And so God, right now in this place, there's many people who are in the same place. The environment's different. The environment's different, but there's a lot that's the same. We'll remember forever the softness of these auditorium chairs. We'll remember the hardness of the concrete floor. We will remember the hum of the air conditioners. We might even remember we're sitting in one of those seats where that air is blowing on the back of our neck and we've been uncomfortable, but we'll remember that we were uncomfortable too and thinking through whether or not we want to receive the gift and give our life to you. God, and the quietness of this place, in this silent moment when all of heaven gazes upon us, pray you would properly direct our response. You know, as we sit here right now, some of us have received this gift before, and you can only receive this once. Certainly, you feel Jesus' life more inside of you sometimes than other, but you only get this gift once. The priest doesn't come into your life and then leave, and you have to ask him back in again. Jesus isn't fickle like that. The priest comes and he stays. For others of us, we've never received this gift. We've done religion. We've never done relationship. Right now, as you sit there, and as the corners of that box pierce your hand, you may be reminded of Jesus' piercing of his hands on the cross. In this holy moment, as you look inside that box, some of us are counting the cost right now, and it's appropriate for you to receive the gift. And ask God into your heart. In your own words, in your own mind, go ahead and ask the priest in. Ask the Son of God, the fulcrum point of human history, into your life. To mark that moment, go ahead and reach in that box and receive the gift. Reach in and receive it. God, I hear those bells. I can hear that the priest lives. I hear that Jesus now has new dwelling places. God, may we always remember the sound of those bells this Christmas. May the sound of those bells remind us of the greatest gift that was ever given, that is the name called Jesus Christ. In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen.